First order of business is, if anybody hasn't noticed, that we have no water in the building. So that is why there's no coffee, and unfortunately that's why there's no bathroom as well. So hopefully everybody's okay. if you need to, get up and walk around the room, jump up and down. Tonight, if you've been joining us, we have Chris has been presenting out of the book for the last couple of weeks. He will continue to do that for the next couple of months, presenting out of the first 164, and he's gone back to actually the original manuscript to present, which is always is bringing an interesting twist to it. And he will continue doing that, going through the steps. But occasionally we're going to have guest speakers come in and talk about a different topic, just kind of to change it up a little bit. And tonight, I'm pretty excited because we have two people that have been friends of the meeting and friends of mine for a long period of time, and they're going to talk about law and AA. Something like that. Yeah. Well, let's see what they have to say. So I will turn the meeting over to Anne-Marie.
Thanks, Dave. My name's Anne-Marie. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here this evening. I have to talk closer to it?
Yes.
All right. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I'm not used to these things, sorry. Actually, people tell me I really am very loud in general, so I usually never have to use these things. But I'm really excited to be here tonight. I was actually reflecting with Rose before I got here how myself, Rose, and Dave were here with Chris in the very beginning when the meeting was downstairs. And that is where I found my first sponsor to take me through the big book process, the first 164. And it truly was a new day. I had no idea how much my life was about to change. When she said to me, "Are you willing to go to any length?" I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure." She's like, "Do you want to think about that?" And I was like, "Nah, I'm ready. Completely ready." And I had no idea what I was ready for, but I knew I was ready. And my journey really took off from there. Just to go back to kind of how I got here, I truly am an alcoholic, and there's no doubt in my mind about that one. I started drinking when I was about 12. I know that Chris had asked Rose and I to talk about sobriety and the law, and as I was thinking about it on the way here, you know, the law, the police, things like that have been an integral part of my entire life. And, you know, the first time I remember the police showing up at my house, I was 5, and I had found my father with a gun to his head, passed out. And I remember coming home from ShopRite, and I came running upstairs to see my dad to show him my lollipop. And I saw him, and he was passed out on the bed, and he had a gun to his head, and I didn't really know what was going on, but I knew something was wrong. And so I went running downstairs to my mom, and I started yelling. I was like, "Mom, Mom, Mom, come here, Dad's upstairs." So when she saw him, she freaked out, grabbed me, run downstairs, and called the police. And I remember the cops coming to the house, and I remember the cops taking my family and I away in one car, and my dad away in the other car. And that was my first experience with the law, was that they separated my family. They took my dad away and made my mom and I go stay someplace else. And then when my dad came home, he told me how awful policemen were when he was drunk, but when he was sober, they were his best friends. And about 7 years later, I started drinking. And my father drank a lot when I was growing up. In fact, I'd say every night. And when I started drinking, I soon learned that if I stole liquor from him, he couldn't yell at me because he wasn't supposed to be drinking. And so, therefore, nobody ever really knew that I had been drinking. From the very beginning, I hid my drinking. From the very beginning, I stole liquor out of the liquor cabinet, drank it, put water in the bottle, put it back in the liquor cabinet, thinking nobody would know. Not realizing my father drank a lot and would probably know he wasn't drunk after like a half a bottle of vodka. But for whatever reason, this made sense. And when I was going through school, I was always the one that would get the alcohol. And I was always the one that had to bring up the alcohol. There was no such thing as going out on Friday night unless we were going to drink. What was the point? Why would I be going out with you? I don't like people. Why would I hang out with people unless I was drunk? But at the same time, I loved people but had no idea how to be around them. It was very confusing. And that was a feeling that never went away. You know, a lot of times I think I brought it up once with my older sister, and she said, like, yeah, you know, that's normal. She was in college at that point. She's like, that's normal when you're a teenager. Well, I just turned 30, and sometimes I feel like that still, you know. I was like, is that still normal, or am I just still a teenager? But I really think that that's a really big part of my alcoholism, is that, you know, I constantly live in a dichotomy of extremes. I'm terrified of people, but I'm terrified to be alone. Where do you go when you have that? You know, there's really no middle ground there. And I've come to find out that the middle ground is a higher power. But getting back to my drinking, I proceeded to drink a lot over the next few years. I ended up with alcohol poisoning and in Morristown Memorial Hospital a lot. I ended up being rushed with the ambulance and police cars to the hospital or the police stations more times than my mother would probably care to admit. And I remember that one of the things I'd always said to myself was that, you know, if I ever got in trouble, like a criminal record, I would definitely stop. I am not of the family that would come home with a criminal record. I am not of the type of person that would come home with a criminal record. And here I was, I didn't think I had an ego, but I totally did. And what happened was, is I was 15 or 16, I think it was 15, and I was drinking at a dance, and I drank so much that I ended up passing out, hitting my head on concrete, giving myself a concussion, and going into like an alcoholic coma for a few hours. And I was rushed to the hospital. And when I woke up, a police officer had come to my house and wanted to know why I was serving minors alcohol. And I really didn't think it was a big deal. I really was like, what's your problem? You know, I really did not, I couldn't understand why everybody was so upset about this. All right, so I had a bad night. Ugh, relax, you know? And that was really my genuine feeling. The other part of me was terrified of what's going to happen, but I was really more concerned of like, oh, well, they'll forget about this in a, you know, in a couple weeks, and I'll be grounded, and then I'll get over it, and we'll go do it again. And as I proceeded through high school, I got into drugs. I smoked a lot of marijuana when I went to boarding school. I continued to drink a lot. And what I found was that I really only did drugs, though, when I couldn't get my hands on alcohol. And that's just for me. First and foremost, my drug of choice was drinking. And as I progressed through boarding school, I found that I was on the verge of getting kicked out because of liquor. Because I drank so much that I went into a blackout and broke into someone's house. I had no idea I broke into someone's house. And I was lucky I didn't call the police then either. And then, lo and behold, just fast forward, I was living in New Orleans. Because where does an alcoholic go for college? New Orleans. And, I mean, my entire decision for college was based on the fact I could drink down there at the age of 18. So that's why I went to college down there, and my very first night I got escorted home by a security officer because I was trying to break into the wrong dorm on the wrong campus in a blackout. And I was insistent that this was my dorm. It's like, I'm telling you, you're even on the wrong road, you know? And that was just the beginning of my drinking there. That was a good night down there. A lot of things happened. I definitely had a very rough road down there. I ended up coming back, and before I came back, my mother had come down to visit me, and she had said to me, had I studied for finals? And I had said no. And so she offered, and she did. She went out and she rented me a laptop computer, and I went down to her hotel room, and I sat there, and she had spent a lot of money on the hotel, a lot of money on dinner, and a lot of money on renting me this computer, and we didn't go out and do anything because I needed to study. So she was totally selfless in the action she was taking towards me. And what happened, but I went downstairs after she fell asleep, genuinely just for a cigarette. I swear to this day, I just wanted a cigarette. I came home at 5:30 in the morning, blitzed out of my mind, kind of faintly remember going out in someone's car whom I just met to do drugs, and then came back and continued to drink, and I remember telling somebody I was from Tennessee and that my name was Mary. And then I told somebody else that my name was Stephanie and I was from California, and that I was there on work, and it was like I was nuts, and I just went into these insane lies when I drank. I loved lying, loved it, and just got such a kick out of being somebody else for the night, you know? And even whenever I got in trouble with, like, the police or schools or whatever, I loved lying still. It was, like, the greatest thing. And so I came home drunk, and my mother woke me up the next morning, which was like an hour later, and she said, "Did you get a lot of work done?" And just the look in her eyes, I just looked at her, and I started crying, and I said, "I have a problem with drinking." And so we went, and we sat downstairs and had breakfast together, and she told me all about my dad, and she told me things I never knew about my dad and about his drinking. And my father was of the opinion that AA makes you get divorced and move to Florida, and that's really an awful place to go. And so that's what I thought AA was. And so my mother told me about that, and she said to me, "Look, you're already registered for summer school. When you come home, we'll deal with this, but just go to summer school." I said, "Okay." And she's, you know, she was very much of the mindset that she was not, she never wanted, you know, you don't buy cars for your children in my family, you earn your car. And, well, at this point now, she didn't really know what else to do with me, and I had no way to summer school, so she said, "I'll buy you a car, just come home and pick one out from the used car lot, and we'll get it on Saturday." I said, "Okay." Well, I came home, and Friday night, I'm driving, I went to pick up a friend of mine, and we went to the movies at Headquarters Plaza, and I had this water bottle, like one of those white water bottles that you can't see through, and I filled it with vodka, and I went into the movie, and I don't even remember what I saw, but I drank half the bottle, and I came out, and I got high in the car, and then I proceeded to drive home. And as I proceeded to drive home, this girl next to me had no idea I had been drinking. I was hiding my drinking at this point. She had no idea I was drunk. And I drove home from Morristown to Summit. And just when I hit the New Providence border, I guess I really needed to get a CD from the back seat. And I leaned over to get it, and the steering wheel went to the right, as did the car, because the car follows the steering wheel. And I hit a telephone pole. I took out the telephone pole. I made the car flip 3.5 times. Sunroof was open, no seatbelt on. And took out of the front yard fence, and woke up with my head against the concrete, and my legs in the back seat, and my head down underneath the steering wheel, and I had no idea how I had gotten there. I didn't know what happened, but I managed to, you know, climb my way out of the window, which I was upside down at this point. And I came crawling out, and the girl that I was driving, who didn't even know I was drunk, is sitting on the side of the road with a bloody nose. And I didn't care how she was. I didn't ask her how she was. My first thought was, "Oh my God, I'm dead. I'm totally dead." And I didn't mean physically. I meant the minute my mother found out, I was dead. And the neighbor comes running out. It's like 1:30 in the morning. She's like, she hears me say, "You're dead, you're dead." She's like, no, you're alive, you're alive." I was like, no, my mom's not here yet. You have no idea. You don't know who this woman is. She's going to kill me. And the funny thing was that as much as I enjoyed lying, the minute the police got there, for whatever reason, I thought that I should be honest. I don't know why. But they came up and they said, "Were you drinking tonight?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Were you doing anything else?" And I said, "Yes." I was so desperate. I was like, yes, I was smoking pot, and I was drinking vodka, and I drove home, and they're like, "Okay." And the paramedics were like, "Shut up." You know, they were like, "Stop talking." And I was like, "And then I did this, and I'm sorry." And they were like, "Okay." And I get to the hospital, and I take my BAC level, and it was outrageously high. It was above 0.3. And the next day, I knew I was in deep trouble. And I can't curse the criminal justice system, because the criminal justice system is the whole reason I'm in AA. I know a lot of people come here court-ordered. I know a lot of people in AA don't like the court-ordered folks. I know a lot of people don't think it works. Well, I've been here for 10 years, and it works. You know, I came here because the judge said so. And I was not happy about it. You know, I actually... I was standing there in the new municipal court, and the judge said to me, given all the drugs I had in the car and the alcohol I had in the car and the fact I was under 21 and the fact I'd taken out a telephone pole and a couple other things and endangered the lives of myself and other people and had about 8 charges slammed against me, he said, "Do you want to go to jail for a year or do you want to go to rehab?" And I just stood there and I had to think about it. Only an alcoholic has to think about that. You know, the thought crossed my mind, well, I can still use in jail. What do I want to do? And if it hadn't been for, you know, my peripheral vision seeing my brother ready to throttle me from across the courtroom, I don't know what decision I would have made. But I said, I'll go to rehab. And he said, all right, court-ordered rehab. And then I was on probation for a year. And I got to say, with what I did, when I think about it now, when I think about how I endangered not only my life, but other people's lives, all the people I might have passed on my way from Summit to, or Morristown to Summit, I should have gotten a lot worse punishment. I should have gotten, I don't even know. But I certainly should not have had the rest of my life, an amazing life at that, handed to me on a silver platter. And that was only the grace of God working through the judge for me. And I am so grateful for that today. And that was the beginning of my journey. I went to rehab, and while I was at rehab, I had my first spiritual experience, which was that I did not know how not to drink. I could not admit that before. I was drinking morning, noon, and night before. I literally woke up in the morning. First thing I did was I drank. Last thing I did at night was I drank. That's what I did. I couldn't drive. My mother was like, I'm not buying you a car now, but you still have to go to summer school. So I biked 15 miles one way to summer school, drinking vodka and orange juice. Like, that was a really hydrating drink for you. But, you know, I even was taking a class, crisis intervention, and passed out in the middle of the class, literally at 9 o'clock in the morning, and became like a case study for my fellow classmates. And it was humiliating, but thank God for that judge. Thank God for the legal system for me. And, you know, it's funny because I ended up working in the legal system a lot. And a lot of my greatest lessons about sobriety have come through working in the legal system. You know, it's like a lot of times, and even in the beginning, people said, you know, just go to meetings. Just don't drink and go to meetings. Just don't drink and go to meetings. And I did that for a while. And then lo and behold, Dave, myself, and our friend Steve ended up in Bernardsville one night in February 1999. And we ended up here for a big book study, and I'll never forget it, because I met this girl, Wendy, here. And then shortly thereafter, we met Cass, and then we ended up having a big book study for women, and I ended up going through the big book steps. And prior to going through the big book, and I have to say, even after having gone through the big book, it was, you know, prior to going through the big book, AA was this lofty, theoretical thing that I just showed up. I went to meetings. I didn't drink. I didn't really know what was going on, but I knew something was working because I hadn't drank and I hadn't killed myself. And those were the only two things that I knew how to do when I got here. And then I went through the big book, the first 164, and I got these concrete, tangible instructions. It said, write down this. And so I wrote down this. It said, pray here, and I prayed here. It said, talk to a person here, and I talked to a person there. And I followed it to a T. I mean, I remember my sponsor gave me a list of instructions to do for my third step, which included no more lying. It's actually in here. It's like no more lying, no more gossiping. You know, choose the right thing. What was the other couple things? Don't judge. Become trustworthy, something along those lines. Needless to say, I didn't speak for 2 weeks because somebody would say, how are you? And I would go to say, fine, and I realized I was lying. But then I didn't want to say I'm great because they don't really want to know. And next thing you know, I'm overthinking the entire thing. And so people are like, well, how are you? And I was like, I'll tell you later. I have to figure it out. I'm not sure. And they just are like, all right, you're crazy. And I'm like, I know. And that was definitely one thing I knew, is I knew I was crazy. And so I went through the big book, and it was an amazing experience. It definitely was. But when I got on the other side of going through the amends, and I had the spiritual awakening that they talk about in the steps, I saw the world in a different light, and I saw people in a different light. And then what happened in that next year were that the principles that I had just spent all this time learning were all in my head, and there was a block to my heart. There was a block, and I couldn't figure out how to get rid of that block. And part of my problem getting rid of the block was that I was thinking about it. And I was thinking, and I was thinking, and I was thinking, and I was trying to figure this out, and completely forgot that my thinking got me here, completely forgot that my thinking was based on drinking in the morning, noon, and night, But for whatever reason, I couldn't get past this block. And at that time, I was working in domestic violence court. And I was sitting there one day, and, you know, you see a lot of awful things when you work in courthouses. I don't know if anybody else has hung out there. I happen to love hanging out there. But, you know, you see a lot of bad things. So I was hanging out in domestic violence court, and this woman comes walking in. And, you know, we had both genders as victims, but this one victim comes walking in. And it was at a point when I was really struggling with my sponsor saying, there's a block. I don't know what the block is, but there's a block. And everything I was doing was coming from my head. And I knew it was coming from my head because when she said it, it hit me and it resonated. But that was the only thing that was hitting me and resonating. So this woman walks in, and she is so black and blue that she's yellow. And she's just, it's just awful. There is not a white part of her skin exposed. And she's wearing a short sleeve shirt. And I will never forget this woman. And she comes in, and she testifies that her husband beat her, and that's why she looked that way. And she testified that her husband picked up the coffee room table and went to go hit her with it, but then instead of doing that, decided to hit the back of the dog with it and killed the dog as he broke the coffee table on the dog's back. And I'm sitting here, and I'm listening to this awful story, and I'm like, oh, my God, how can a human being do that? They should have the 12 steps. They should need to go through the big book. I don't even know if he's an alcoholic, but this is what he needs to do. And da, 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 da. And lo and behold, this guy stands up in court and just starts sobbing and says, I'm an alcoholic and I can't stop drinking. And I was so touched because for the first time, I knew that it was not only by the grace of God that that could be me, I knew that he was me. It wasn't that it could be. I was him, and he was I. And it was that simple. And all of a sudden, the whole concept of not judging became part of my fiber. And it had nothing to do with me, and had nothing to do with thinking. It had nothing to do with even really anything but work in the 12 steps and showing up, and then God took care of the results like the book promises us. And I thank God for him. I really, really, truly do. Because to me, that was like the worst thing that you could be. And I could tell you that I didn't judge you, but I did. You know, and after that, when I saw him say that, I actually had to leave the courtroom because I was ready to burst out into tears. And since this was my job, I did not want to do that. But I remember going home and calling my sponsor and crying hysterically. And she said, Anne-Marie, you are not him. And I said, no, Cass, I am. And I'm okay with that. Because I know that it's by the grace of God that I don't act like that today. But I know that as an alcoholic, that is what I am. That is the dark side of our disease. Right now, I'm living the light side of our disease. You know, when you live in the program and in the 12 steps and the promises come true. But that was an amazing experience. And shortly thereafter, other things like that would start to happen. And I started going through the steps again with my sponsor, and I started going through another 4-step, and I got to a different level of honesty. And when I sat down and I took a really good look at my honesty, I found that I was sitting there and I was verbally abusing my husband. He wasn't my husband at the time, but I was verbally abusing him at home. So I'm sitting here and I'm going to work every day and I'm judging all these quote-unquote batterers, and I'm doing the same thing. How is that? How is that? And my sponsor would always say to me, we only judge what we are. And I knew it. But I never wanted to face what I was because I was so scared of the truth, because I was so scared of turning into it. And then I realized that if I didn't face it, I would turn into it. Facing it was not the problem. Running from it was. And it was through these things of listening to my sponsor and just getting up in the morning and putting my first foot forward, that all these principles of AA started to take on a meaning outside of my head. And I started to experience it. And as I was experiencing it, a different spiritual awakening seemed to be happening like every day. And it was a bizarre experience, and it continues to be a bizarre experience, but it's a beautiful experience. And once I realized that that's what I was doing as I was judging it, I applied the 12 steps to it, and it went away. It didn't go away because I had the power to stop acting differently. It went away because I worked the 12 steps and I got God involved in it and he decided to remove it. But I needed that experience because I needed to stop judging people who were abusive. I needed to stop hiding in my victim role. I needed to experience that. And so I did. And then God removed it like it talks about in 6 and 7. And in one of the things I love about 6 and 7 is that it always talks about you don't know what's good or bad. A lot of things that appear bad might be great. A lot of things that appear good might be really bad. You don't know when you're on this journey. And it's a great thing. It keeps things interesting. You know, kind of a little off the topic, I actually had an experience with that where my husband and I had been having a hard time communicating the last, like, 4 or 5 months, presently. And he gave me these diamond earrings for Christmas. And he's given me jewelry, but these diamond earrings meant a lot to me. It touched a part of me that was like, wow. It just hit a chord in me that I can't even really articulate yet, but it just hit something in me that was like, wow, you really do care about me. As if I didn't know that, but I needed to be reminded. And we go away, and 2 days after Christmas, I lose the earring. Yeah. I dropped the earring somewhere. I don't know where it went. And that night I went back to the hotel, and I was upset about losing the earring, but it was weird. I just had this feeling that it was going to be okay. And I didn't know whether it was going to be okay. It was actually going to materialize in the earring. I was kind of hoping. I was really, you know, plugging for God that my earring would show back up. But, you know, I was like, God, whatever you want, help me accept it. And so what happened was I opened up to my husband and I told him exactly what it meant to me. And the block of communication that we had been having for 5 months was gone the next day. It was like we had just gotten married. It was like it was just 100% gone. My best friend was back. I loved him to death. He became the greatest guy in the world again. And it was all because I finally got rigorously honest and wasn't afraid of what he was going to think of me. You would think that this person I wouldn't care, but I actually care most what he thinks. And it was gone. Well, when did you know the next day? I literally went back to the train station. I looked down because I had a feeling. I looked down next to a sewer was my diamond earring. I picked it up and put it back in my ear and said, thank you, God. And my sponsor said to me, she goes, see, you don't know what's good or bad. Losing your diamond earring was a really good thing. You needed it. And I said, you're right. I did. So, anyway, I then went over to England for a while, and I'll just give you a couple more examples of how actually certain things with the law have really helped put these principles into action. And it's something as simple as getting pulled over. I've gotten pulled over so many times, it's ridiculous. I actually don't drive that fast anymore, which is good. But I got pulled over and numerous times. They come up to me and they're like, where are you going? And this one last time I said, home. Because my sponsor told me I was no longer allowed to lie. Once I took the third step, no more lying. Hence why I didn't talk for a long time. But it was, you know, they said, where are you going? And I said, home. And they said, well, why are you going so fast? And I said, because it's been a long day. I just want to go home. And he was like, do you know why I pulled you over? I said, yes. He said, why? I said, I was speeding. He said, do you know how fast you were going? I said, yeah, I was going 80. He's like, do you know what the speed limit is? I was like, mm-hmm, it's 50. I'm fully aware of it, officer. I am completely aware that I broke the law, and I really am just going home because law and order starts in like 10 minutes. And he was like, he was so confused that he just handed me my license and was like, slow down. And I was like, okay. You know, before I used to sweat it out, like, how can I possibly get out of taking this ticket? Like, oh, you know, my mom's dying, my aunt had a stroke, my, you know, sister's in labor, I gotta go, you know. I always had these outlandish things. Never in a million years did I actually think telling the truth would work. You know, it's like, my sponsor told me in the very beginning, every time you tell the truth, you will have a spiritual experience. Why? Because you are a liar. As an alcoholic, you're a liar. And I was like, you're right, I am. She's like, when you breathe, you lie. I said, you're right, I do. You know, that any time I have told the truth, I have a spiritual experience because I surprise myself and I usually surprise the person I'm talking to. And it's just a better way of life. And a couple other things, you know, I know a lot of people, when they come into AA, they have a lot of problems with the law. And I've seen a lot of people come into the court and, you know, they say, I love reading the Star Ledger when you actually see in the paper, like, years later, this guy comes in and says, I mugged so-and-so. I need to go to jail. And you know it's because they're making amends through the big book. You know it's because the big book said, if we have criminal offenses, guess what? You turn yourself in. That's what we do. You know, and who would have thought that such an amazing program would touch so many people? Because I do. I see it touch people in the criminal justice system. When we come in and make amends and turn ourselves in, we actually show these people that the system works, that people take responsibility for their actions. And with how many people are arrested day in and day out on drug and alcohol offenses, it's scary. Rose and I were talking that it's like at least half of the prison population. At least half. So if anyone's not involved in service, I would strongly recommend corrections. It needs us. It desperately needs us. Shortly after I stopped working in domestic violence, I actually moved over to London, England, and started working in a court over there. And that was a great experience as well, in terms of getting to interact with different people and learning how my principles transcend time and space, because God transcends time and space. You know, when my husband first said to me, I think we need to move to London because I want to get a master's degree, I looked at him and I said, have fun, I'll see you when you get home. And he thought I was kidding, and I wasn't. And he kind of like, what? And once I found out my cats could go, I said, fine, I'll go. And so we moved to London, but as far as I was concerned, God only lived in New Jersey, and North Jersey at that, really, above Monmouth County. And I was terrified to go. And the irony is that I felt at home when I went into AA meeting, and I felt at home when I walked into a courthouse. Why? Because the two biggest lessons I have learned in my life happened in both those places. You know, I'm grateful for the legal system today. I really am. The legal system to me is a lot like sobriety. It has these rules and these regulations, and it has these steps, and it tells you when to do things when and how to do things why, and then your matter somehow gets figured out and decided. And that's exactly what sobriety is. It's like I show up, I do the things I'm told to do, and God takes care of the results. I've been trying to figure out for a long time now how and why that happens. And every time I do, I have a very bad day and I like don't do things like find diamond earrings. You know, but when I'm actually working this program to the best of my ability, and I don't just mean in my head, I don't just mean spouting big book lines, I don't just mean spouting step book lines, I mean actually taking the principles and putting them in my life. My life is very, very different. It is better than anything I have ever, ever encountered. And in sobriety, if there's one thing that's always been true, it's that honesty is number one. Because honesty is my key and my door to everything. If I can be honest, the willingness will come. If I can be honest, the grace will come. If I can be honest, recovery will come. Relief comes right away. Recovery comes eventually. All through being honest. Same thing in the legal system. So if anyone's dealing with child custody or child support or DWIs, whatever the case may be, this program, there is no secret to getting out of it. There is no secret to getting through the legal system yet now as an AA member. We don't give you like some magic key and all of a sudden your problems go away. But we do give you a kit of spiritual tools. And if you use them, your problems will go away. Believe it or not, I am testimony to it. 100%. And for that, I truly am grateful today. So I'm going to stop there and give it to Rose, but thanks for letting me share.
I'm working on it.
I'm just kidding.
It's for the recording, not for the sound, actually. I've gotten a couple of CDs where you can't hear the speaker. It's really terrible. My name is Rose. I'm an alcoholic. When Chris had asked us to do this, I was kind of, I was like, the law, what do you mean? And I've worked in the legal field for a while, you know, after I got sober. And I was involved with the law before I got sober, and had to do a bunch of legal stuff after I got sober, and it's been a long road. When I think about when I was younger, it's actually funny because I got pulled over a lot. I did lots of DWI tests. I don't know how I didn't get a DWI because I was always, 99% in the bag. And for some reason, they never did a breathalyzer on me. I have no idea why. No idea. And but back then, it was like, I would get tickets. I wouldn't pay them. I'd get a surcharge. I'd have late fees, and then I wouldn't pay them, and then they'd yank my license, and then I'd drive with no license. And then I'd get caught driving on the revoked, and then I didn't have insurance because I didn't have a registration, and it was like, everything just kept piling up and piling up and piling up and piling up. So I spent a lot of time in municipal courts, and I spent a lot of time manipulating my way through it. And, I had a friend who had a friend who had a friend who owed him a favor, and he happened to be the prosecutor of one town, and he was going to represent me in this other town and talk to the guy and get me out and da-da-da-da. And it was so anxiety-producing and so stressful, and it was horrible. It was just horrible. When I was drinking, I also went through a very messy divorce with a horrific child custody battle. And that was actually a time period where the legal system worked very, very well for me, even when I was completely out of my mind drunk. And it was, I had an amazing experience with the people of Legal Aid. In New Jersey, they have legal aid for people who can't pay for attorneys. And they represented me and took care of my situation for me and helped me through everything, which was incredible. And at that point, I kind of changed on my ideas about the law and the courts and how they work and all that kind of stuff. I realized that there's actually help out there for people who are struggling. In 98, I got sober, and I had an incredible amount of debt, and I had a car repossessed. I had been evicted. I had, all that kind of stuff as a result of my drinking. And I had to declare bankruptcy. So then I was involved in the federal bankruptcy courts and all that kind of stuff. And I found out how that worked. And that was the first time I was actually really, really honest about everything. And it went really smoothly. There was no fighting. There was no anxiety. It was just, this is what I have to do. I have to fill out these papers. I have to go and see this person. I have to tell them the truth, and then I leave, and it's done. And it was done, which was really, really good. I used to lose my driver's license on a regular basis for, points, just speeding all over the place. And I've been pulled over several times in sobriety, but I have not gotten a speeding ticket in over 9.5 years. And it's really funny because now if I do get pulled over, I can actually say to the officer, they say, how's your driving record? And I can look at him straight in the eye and say, it's clean. The first time I said that, I started crying. And it was funny because I didn't want to cry because I didn't want him to think that I was trying to play a game with him by getting all teary-eyed or anything like that. It was the first time I was actually capable of saying, my driver's license is clean. It had never been clean from 30 days after I got my license on. So, and it's funny because when your driver's license is clean, they tend to want you to keep it that way. They actually give you warnings. I didn't know the cops could do that. I had no idea. I didn't think that it was legal for them to do that. And what Amory was saying about, telling the truth, like, it's so funny because I went to school and taking a lot of criminal courses and law courses and things like that. And a lot of my teachers are ex-cops. And, I had already gotten into the habit of being honest with cops if I got pulled over, just, not fighting it, yes sir, no sir, thank you. Please, being polite, it's just, nice. It's when I heard their side of it, my view on the whole criminal system changed. You know, one of my professors said to me, you know, he's like, you know, when I'm walking up to a car, he goes, I have no idea what I'm coming up to. It could just be somebody speeding. It could also be, you know, the serial killer that's going to be on the news tonight. You don't know. You just don't know what you're walking up to. Somebody appears to be drunk. They could be going into a diabetic coma. It looks the same. You know, they don't know. They have to assess the situation really, really quickly and all this other stuff. And I was like, wow, I would really hate to have to do that. So the next time a cop walks up to my car, my hands are on the wheel. I'm like, yes, sir. No, sir. I have my documents right here, sir. And, you know, it's funny because they're calm. You know, they treat me with respect because I treat them with respect. And it just works out really well. I treat them no differently than I do anybody else that comes along my path. And I learned to do that, how to treat other human beings through doing the 12 steps and having spiritual awakening and making the amends for treating people poorly. I still don't know how I never got a DWI. It blows my mind. It really does, because I drove drunk almost every day. Like, car accidents drunk. I mean, just everything. I still don't understand how I didn't get one. It's mind-boggling to me. The other thing that came up when Chris was talking about, you know, the legal system in sobriety, or the law in sobriety, was amends. You know, just amends right there. And it's very, very clear, you know, about what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to handle it. And, you know, I wasn't like a big stealer. I didn't steal anything. I wasn't a thief, except when it came to my parents. And I stole food from them. That's what I did. I actually stole food from them, which is bizarre because they would have given it to me. But I actually made amends for stealing to my parents. And it was the most embarrassing part of it. Out of all the things that I had made amends for, making amends to my parents for going in their basement when they weren't home and going into the alleyway with a shopping bag that I brought and taking food off of their shelves. You know, they had 12 cans of tomatoes and I'd take two. You know, I'd take half the stack of paper plates and, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I did. And I made amends to each of them for stealing the food, and they both said to me, they looked at me and they go, well, we would have given it to you, you know. I'm like, I know. They're like, did you do it when we weren't home? I'm like, oh, yeah. I didn't even have a key to the house. I had to break in or get one of my sisters to let me in the house in order to get the food. I mean, it's bizarre. I'm glad that I the only other time I ever stole anything, it was a lip gloss from the drugstore in Chester, and I stole it, and I walked out the door, and I felt so guilty, I went back, and I put it back on the shelf. I couldn't do it. It was bizarre. I was really good at breaking laws, though. I've always been very good at breaking laws, you know. I have an unbelievable lead foot. At least I used to. I don't anymore. I used to drive with no insurance because it was really expensive, you know. There was a time when my driving thing was so bad that in order for me to get like I was actually making good money and I wanted to get like a decent car, you know, like that was built within the last decade, and I could afford the car, but I could not afford the insurance because my license was so bad. I ended up driving a clunker that I paid like $300 for, and I paid $2,200 a year just for liability. It was unreal. I found out that when you start following the law and actually obeying the law and doing, you know, did you know that driving in the state of New Jersey is a privilege, not a right? You know, I thought it was a right. It's a privilege. And I found out that when you abuse that privilege, then things get really bad really fast. When you respect it, it's funny because my insurance now, I have full coverage on my car, and it's way less than a third of that $2,200, you know. And that's a result of me actually being responsible, following the law, being respectful, you know, paying the stupid surcharge for not having my driver's license on me, you know, like all that stuff. When I work with girls, I have a lot of girls who hate the DMV, which is funny. And I've heard a lot of resentments about people who hate the state of New Jersey, you know, not to mention that they broke any of the laws. And, you know, it's, you know, they talk about it, they don't really talk about it in here, but it's a biblical type of thing. You know, they talk about we reap what we sow, you know. And if I'm sowing poison seeds, what I'm going to get is poison fruit, you know. And that's kind of how it works regarding, you know, the legal system and, you know, how these things work out. Back last year, I had a restraining order on my ex-husband for 12 years. It was not a frivolous restraining order. It was a restraining order that was necessary, and it was a very bad scene. And last November, so I haven't had any contact with him, and he was on my amends list, and I couldn't make direct amends to him because I had a restraining order against him, and I'm not allowed to break it either, so, and I didn't know where he was, and I had an idea, but I didn't know how to get in touch with him. Last November, my daughter found him on the internet and started corresponding with him. I was like, oh my God. And she's like, I want to see my father. And I was like, okay. And I, you know, if this had happened 6 years ago, I would have said, absolutely not. No way. He's a dangerous man. You know. Wait until you're 18. Then you can do whatever you want. But, you know, I've been through this process a couple of times, and I've had, I have a lot of help and I have a lot of guidance in my life. And instead of reacting to the whole situation with fear, I actually contacted the courts. I spoke to them, found out what my options were. They referred me to a domestic violence counselor. I spoke to them. They told me that I needed to drop the restraining order if I wanted to participate in voluntary mediation. I spoke to my counselor. I spoke to a couple of my professors who were the ex-cops. I spoke to my sponsor. I spoke to my family members because it affects them too. And I reached out to my ex-husband and I asked him if he'd be willing to participate in voluntary mediation, free mediation, and through the courts. And he said yes. I went to the court in January of last year and I dropped the restraining order. I had to sit in the courthouse for a couple hours, you know, talk to all the proper people again. Sit in front of the judge, explain what I'm doing, and he reviewed everything, and he put it all on the record, and he said to me, he goes, basically you're doing this so that, you know, for the sake of your daughter. And I said, yes. He goes, so you're dropping a restraining order that's been in effect for 12 years for the sake of your daughter. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, good luck. I wish you all the luck in the world. If you ever have a problem, please come back. Okay. In May, we had our first mediation session. Went smoothly. He agreed to supervise visitation with my daughter on a weekly basis with the counselor as a mediator, you know, third-party person. We did that. Then they had a visitation, you know, like not in the counselor's office because she told me that she would really like to spend more than an hour with him. I said, okay. They went to a movie. The next time they met, she met his wife, and I met his wife, and it's kind of proceeded from there. She just spent the last 2 weekends at his house in Pennsylvania. This all went so smoothly, I can't even explain how smooth this went. My relationship with my ex-husband and his wife is probably one of the most peaceful relationships that I have in my life today. Which is bizarre, you know. In 1995, I had him removed from the home because I was afraid he was going to kill me. He tried. He stalked me. I used to call the cops on him if I saw his car driving by. I used to call the IRS and tell him he wasn't paying taxes. I used to call the cops because I'd see him driving, and I knew he didn't have a driver's license in New Jersey that was legal, like me. You know, like all this vindictive stuff going on. It's mind-boggling to me. There's no way I would have been able to do any of this stuff without the legal system supporting me. You know, it's proven to be an incredible safety net. You know, they've managed, you know, it's very procedural, and it's just, it's very similar to the step work, and it's like, you know, there's steps to take, and you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this, and you do this, and if this happens, you go this way, and if this happens, you go that way. And it's like, that's, you just need to follow it. You can't jump from step one to step 18 in the legal process and hope to make it out of there, you know, with anything good happening. You have to do it one by one by one by one. Follow the process. And it takes a lot of patience. Being an alcoholic, I am not a patient person, so that's a lot of practice. You know, careful when you pray for patience. You might get it. It's amazing to me now because, like, I'm always interested. I have a girlfriend who is a statistician for the Department of Justice, and I love talking to her about what projects she's working on. It's so great. And she actually heads a team that sends out people to interview prisoners. She works with the prison population. And it's kind of amazing because every once in a while I'll look her stuff up online. And, you know, a couple of these reports that I pulled down, it talks about, you know, the percentages of prison inmates today, you know, municipal, federal, and state, anywhere from... You know, the percentages range depending on what you're looking at, but it's like basically between 35 and 50% of all inmates in, you know, across the board, they're in there because of drug-related, under the influence, or drug-related crimes, alcohol-related crimes, or crimes they committed when they were under the influence of either or both. It's amazing to me, you know. And that's where I'd be. You know, I'm one of those people that I was so out of control when I was drinking and drugging. I mean, just everything that I did was so out of control and insane, just insane. And I thought that I was entitled to break the law somehow. I was better than the rest of the population, and I didn't really need to follow the rules like you people did. And, you know, I'm... If I had continued on the way I was going, it was just a matter of time before I ended up being, you know, just another one of my friend Paige's stats. About a year, was it a year and a half, 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to visit somebody in state prison, Bayside State Prison. It's all the way at the bottom of the state. It's not like New Jersey down there. I didn't actually realize I was still in New Jersey. It was bizarre. And it was, you know, it was a drug offense. He had gotten probation. He violated the probation. He went to prison. It happens, you know. It was unbelievable what I saw there. It was frightening. It was terrifying. And, I mean, I used to go to places that, you know, little 20-year-old hippie chick should be going to, you know, which is what I did when I was, you know, younger. But this was like a rude awakening. And I looked around, and this kid is in there. He was in there for a drug offense, and he's in there with rapists and murderers. They treat us the same. He's just an addict, you know. But they treat us the same because it's breaking the law, period, you know. When we don't deal with things, when we have stuff that's, you know, outstanding things, things that we have to take care of, whether it's, you know, past due bills or tickets that aren't paid, you know, all those kinds of things. Like, I forgot to pay a ticket. You know, I got a ticket for having an expired license. I didn't realize it expired, honestly, but he gave me the ticket and I forgot to pay it. I got one notice and I didn't pay it. And I got the thing saying, you're losing your license. And I was like, ah! You know, it's one of those things where, like, as long as I'm on top of it, it's okay. It's going to work out fine. You know, you just got to follow the process. And, you know, actually playing by the rules is something that, you know, I never really thought I had to do. In sobriety, I do. I have to play by the rules. And when I play by the rules, things work out really, really well, even in the worst situations. I've thought about going into the whole, into the legal profession and going to law school and all that stuff. I'm hoping to do it in the future. As part of my schooling, I got to sit in a courthouse down in Somerville in criminal court, and it was just one day. It was like 2 hours or something. And the guy gave me the docket. He let me look over the docket, and about 75% of them were drug offenses, alcohol-related, you know, things that they had done when they were drunk in a blackout, whatever. These people were going away. They were going away. There was this one guy, he was like, what did I say? It was like $5 in change that he stole out of somebody's car. It's his third offense. Done. Gone to prison. For like less than $10. He broke into a car. You know, why? To get drug money. Unbelievable. This happens to us all the time. You know. And the thing that I know is that if I don't stay on this path and I don't continue to be rigorously honest in everything that I do, I've got no chance. My goose is cooked. You know, that's really all I know. So, that's it.